Lights illuminate the front of the Natural History Museum. Inside, a blue whale skeleton with its jaws open is suspended from the ceiling in a large hall. Stephen Fry walks into the building.
Magical creatures have fascinated us ever since we first walked the Earth. Whether created entirely from the imagination or inspired by the animals around us, mythical beasts have captured our attention for thousands of years. But why, in this modern age of science and technology, are we still so captivated by these fantastic beasts? And what are the truths that lie behind the myths, the magic, and the legends?
He heads up some stairs, passing a statue of Charles Darwin, a Niffler. A creature similar to a mole with a pink platypus-like snout appears on Darwin's shoulder. It then scampers off.
Join me on a journey of exhilarating exploration and daring discovery as we uncover the secrets behind some of our best-loved mythical creatures. Oh, my heavens. Wow.
Revealing the real-life beasts behind some of the greatest legends in history.
You look at some of nature's extraordinary creations and you think, well, CGI will never match this.
And finding out why the world of magical animals is more popular today than ever before.
These are the extraordinary stories of the world's most fantastic beasts.
BBC Fantastic Beasts and Natural History, presented by Stephen Fry. Stephen walks along a corridor where a large fossil is mounted on a wall.
This is one of the greatest treasure troves of the natural world. London's Natural History Museum is a cornucopia of unique and fascinating collections from across the globe.
It's also a place where the worlds of science and fiction have been known to overlap. I'll be exploring the museum's labyrinth of corridors and cabinets and uncovering the stories that continue to fascinate millions of people today, from the legendary creatures of ancient mythology to the magical animals of Harry Potter and the Wizarding World.
Stories like these. The mythical beasts and magical creatures within these pages appear to be pure fantasy, but things aren't always quite that simple.
We begin our story with arguably the best-known mythological animal on the planet, the dragon.
A heading in a book reads, "Here be dragons," and flames spread across the page opposite. In a room with many pillars, there are rows upon rows of display cabinets. One contains shiny minerals and ores, including a gold nugget. The Niffler moves along the cabinet, sniffing. The Niffler stops and looks through the glass, then starts crawling across it. Stephen walking, then the display cabinet with its gold nugget now missing.
One of the most ancient and universal of our mythological creatures, the dragon has enthralled the human race for thousands of years. But where did the idea for this creature first take flight? Was there a spark of truth behind the dragon myth?
People moving a long, colorful model of a dragon with metal poles.
Chinese New Year is often celebrated around the world with a traditional dragon dance.
Stephen watches as the dragon's carried through a street.
In the dance, the dragon represents wisdom, power, and wealth, and it's believed that performing the dance scares off evil spirits and brings good luck. But why the dragon? What is it about this creature that so excites and mesmerizes us?
The dragons moved from side to side with the poles.
Many cultures around the world have a dragon myth, although they often vary in appearance. European dragons are usually seen as terrifying, fire-breathing beasts with wings and horns. Whereas Asian dragons are depicted as wise, benevolent creatures with a more serpent-like appearance. In Aztec culture, the dragon-like god Quetzalcoatl was often shown with feathers and sharp fangs, while others, like the rainbow serpent from Australian Aboriginal mythology, have a large reptilian head and monstrous teeth.
But if you take a closer look at the dragon, you can see that many of its features are borrowed from real animals. Animals that have a fearsome reputation.
A dragon's large, powerful talons are like those of an eagle. Its sharp teeth and strong limbs are like a lion's. And its scales and hissing tongue are similar to a snake's.
One recent scientific theory suggests that the dragon is simply a combination of those three animals, the animals that our early ancestors were most afraid of.
An interesting idea indeed, but what lies behind this theory?
The dragon model with pointed teeth.
I visited San Diego Zoo in California to meet a little creature that could help to explain.
Oh, now. Who have we here?
So this is our vervet family.
This chap here with the blue bottom, he's looking rather alarmed.
So that is our dominant male in the family. There's some new enrichment in their enclosure that they haven't seen before, so he's letting everyone know there's something new.
When you say enrichment, do you mean that earthen pot?
Correct.
They've never seen it before?
Never seen it before. It has mealworms in there, has peanuts, so they have to reach their hand in.
Right.
But because it's something new in their environment, he started making the alert call, and I don't know if you noticed, they all started to jump into the trees.
They did, didn't they? And they were all responding to his, hey, there's something new here.
There is something new, we don't know what it is, everyone go to your post.
Vervet monkeys can be found across most of Africa and usually live in large groups known as troops. Studies have revealed that they communicate in a highly sophisticated way, using different alarm calls for specific predators to warn their troop of approaching danger.
Vervets run off.
Is it a very particular kind of warning that they know means something on the ground rather than something on a tree?
They do. They have three different calls. So they have one for something that's on the ground, like a snake.
Oh, right.
They have a different call for something's in the air, like a bird of prey.
Yeah.
And then they have another call for big cats.
Those are the three things that are most likely to threaten them.
Correct.
So that was a snake call, was it? Because they were all looking down.
It was. They were all up on their tiptoes. They were all looking down at it.
Of course.
It's exactly what they do for a snake. And, you know, I was cleaning their bedrooms one time, yeah, and they started to do the same call for the water hose.
Really? Yeah, of course. A hose is a green snake,
yeah,
isn't
they're
it?
Like, what is that?
So what does this all mean? Well, it's thought that vervet alarm calls indicate a very deep-rooted fear of these three predators. And we humans, as the primate cousins of the vervet monkey, share the same instinctive fears of big cats, birds of prey, and snakes. And perhaps that primal fear is what led people around the world to combine these three deadly animals into their own unique version of the almighty dragon. But there is another theory behind the legend of the dragon, and it's based on a group of formidable reptiles that walked the earth millions of years ago.
Stephen looks out at a vast desert landscape with lots of rocks on the dry-looking ground. There are mountains in the distance and clouds in the pale sky above.
If you've ever wanted to dig up a dinosaur, then this is the place to come. I am surrounded by thousands of dinosaur fossils here. I'm in the Valley of Bones.
Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry in Utah, America, has the densest concentration of Jurassic dinosaur fossils ever found on the planet. So, have they dug up anything here that can help us decipher the dragon myth? I'm meeting with two of the quarry's top experts, Mike Leschin and Casey Dooms, to find out.
So in terms of recent human history, when was this place discovered?
We know that people knew about the area since probably at least the late 1800s. First Europeans undoubtedly stumbled across a lot of different finds of dinosaur fossils and all kinds of things.
Because they were visible.
Eroding out of the hills, eroding out these formations, these geological features.
Bones poking up through the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike, the Europeans, the ranchers in the 18th century, they had no reason to suppose that the creatures that were exhibited there were extinct. And some people still kind of get confused in their head, don't they?
Yeah.
About the fact that obviously we never coexisted with these creatures.
Oh yeah, I've had people come out here and say, I'm here because I don't believe in dinosaurs.
Really?
And yeah, so it's like, well, go look down there. And then we'll talk.
What about the non-Europeans, the Native Americans, the Ute?
The Ute tribe is the local tribe. They knew they were the remains of a living creature.
Yeah.
And their attitude was to respect that and leave it alone.
Dinosaur fossils have been found on every continent on Earth. Could they be behind the dragon story? If you take a look at the T-Rex with its terrifying teeth, sharp claws, and enormous size, you can see how the idea could arise. Some ancient civilizations did believe fossils were the bones of dragons. Over 1,500 years ago, Chinese medical scholars used dragon bones in recipes for many ailments, but it's thought these were actually fossilized dinosaur bones.
Goodness me, what is this place?
So this is the actual Cleveland Lloyd dinosaur quarry.
And you've enclosed it to show off these amazing specimens.
So over here we have some back vertebrae from a Camarasaurus.
From what animal?
Camarasaurus, so it's a herbivorous dinosaur, one of the big long necks. Right next to it we have a tail vertebrae of an Allosaurus.
Oh yeah?
The big predator, the major predator of the day.
You can really see here, Casey, can't you, how the dragon myth can arise?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if you're finding stuff like this. That is a single tooth of an Allosaurus.
Oh my goodness, I can feel its serrations. Saw-like, like a steak knife for cutting through flesh.
And still, after 147 million years, you can still see them and you can still feel them.
I mean, that's a dragon's tooth. There's no question about it, is it? It's just... Wow, I'll give it back to you. It's very valuable. Look at that.
Indigenous American mythology features dragon-like creatures such as the pyosaur bird with feathery wings, elk's horns, and a long spiked tail. And the Garshongeta dragon, a lake-dwelling, fire-breathing beast. Perhaps these creations were inspired by fossils like those discovered here in Utah.
If I was here some 1,000 years ago or so, it's easy to see how if someone dug up something like this, it could conjure up the image of a dragon and terrifying it would be. Because how could I know that this was from a species that had gone extinct millions of years ago? As far as I was concerned, this was one of a species that was still very much alive and might swoop down on me at any moment.
Stephen holding part of a dinosaur skull and looking skywards, then a CGI dragon soaring through low clouds.
In the world of mythical beasts, there is another creature that's as universally recognized as the dragon.
A red steam train, then a sign at a platform saying 9¾ Hogwarts Express.
You know, there's one mythical creature whose popularity seems to be even greater today than it's ever been. And it's one of the few magical animals that isn't a terrifying monster. Indeed, it's famous for its peaceful, benevolent nature. I'm talking, of course, about the unicorn. One more!
On the train.
I'm on my way to a country which was once so convinced that this mystical creature was real that they named it their national animal.
He shuts the carriage door.
Often depicted as a beautiful horse-like creature with flowing mane and long spiraled horn, the unicorn is a symbol of purity and innocence. Believed to have magical powers, the unicorn's horn was said to heal sickness and protect against poison. In recent years, unicorns have seen a huge surge in popularity. But this adoration is nothing new in Scotland, where the unicorn has been revered for centuries. So what is this obsession all about? I've come to Stirling Castle to meet historian Professor Donna Heddle to find out.
Professor Heddle.
Oh, call me Donna.
Donna, what a place.
A unicorn on a tapestry.
Oh my goodness. Unicorns absolutely everywhere.
I know, it's splendid, isn't it?
And there are more all around the room.
This tells us the story of the hunt of the unicorn. So it's an allegorical piece based on tapestries we know that were in the collection of James V. I think they're called The History of the Unicorn.
America has a bald eagle and France has a cockerel and we have a lion in England. You in Scotland don't have a real animal. You have a mythical animal. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think at the time when it was chosen, people did think it was real. They did believe in it. But it's a kind of a thing in the 15th century. Lots of kings were adopting animals as their personal symbols. And the unicorn became the symbol of Scotland because it is untamable, it is undefeatable.
Oh, so that's a symbol of Scotland's sense of itself.
Absolutely. It's brave, it's courageous. What's not to like? How cool is that for a national symbol?
Yes.
In the Middle Ages, the evidence used to prove that unicorns existed came from another mysterious creature entirely.
A genuine unicorn horn. Or is it, in fact, a narwhal tusk?
I think it's a narwhal tusk.
In fact, it's a replica of a narwhal tusk, because we wouldn't have such a thing. Obviously, they belong on the narwhal's head. They sort of grow up like that. I mean, extraordinary things on the narwhal. And you can see why somebody enterprising, who unfortunately caught one of those whales and sawed off his tusk, would have thought, I can sell this as a unicorn horn, because that's just what it looks like.
And it's quite beautiful.
The narwhal is an elusive toothed whale found in Arctic waters. The spectacular tusk, usually only found on male narwhals, is actually an overgrown, spiralized tooth. Scientists are still unsure as to what exactly the tusk is for, but it's thought that it may be used to break through ice, help catch fish, or possibly to impress female narwhals.
I believe I'm right in saying that these did change hands for quite astonishing sums of money.
Vast sums of money. We know that Queen Elizabeth first paid £10,000, and that's kept in the Tower of London, for example, so it's a very high-status object.
Who created this market?
Well, there were mainly people who were fishing in the north of Norway or Greenland, in the Arctic, Scandinavia. They would come across the narwhals, and it was a huge trade.
And the idea was that it obviously was a symbol of your own power and wealth, but also that it would protect you in some way?
That's right, the purity of the unicorn. This was believed to be able to purify water and to guard against poisons. Also in rather more mundane fashion, to cure boils and plague. And it was used by apothecaries up until the 18th century. It was called alicorn, the powder. A mere pinch of this would have been beyond the dreams of ordinary men.
Right.
It's thought the first written reference to unicorns dates back to over 2,000 years ago. Over that time, many real animals have been linked with this mythical creature. The Arabian oryx, also known as the Arabian unicorn, has two long, slender horns, and when viewed in profile, their horns can appear as one, making them closely resemble a unicorn.
Two Arabian oryx.
But there's another rather different animal that is part of the unicorn story. One that may have the strongest connection of all.
Rhinos, then a giraffe.
There they are, the little armored tanks.
Sitting in a tram with wooden sides, Stephen's watching two rhinos walking.
The rhinoceros, the rhino, surely one of nature's most iconic creatures, with its unmistakable thick grey hide and its signature horn. I call it one of nature's masterpieces. An extraordinary, unique beauty, aren't you? Yes.
A rhino is standing near the side of the tram.
These magnificent creatures are Indian rhinoceros, and their scientific species name is, splendidly, Rhinoceros unicornis. And they are, in fact, distantly related to a real unicorn. Oh, come now, Stephen. Well, millions of years ago, a creature called Elasmotherium sibericum, the Siberian unicorn, roamed between Asia and Europe and around for many, many millions of years. These prehistoric rhinos wouldn't have looked terribly different to the ones we know today. But they were enormous, twice the size of modern rhinos, at around 3 meters tall, covered in thick, shaggy hair, and thought to have a single large horn. The Siberian unicorn is believed to have grazed almost entirely on grass, and despite its large size, was built to run at speed across the plains. They survived all the way up to about 39,000 years ago when they became extinct. But at that time, we were there. We, Homo sapiens, we'd developed language, and so we were able to tell each other about meeting these incredible creatures. What would we have thought of them? Perhaps that's another reason why the idea of the unicorn entered the human imagination.
The sky is dark above the Natural History Museum. Inside, there's a large library where several books are pushed off a shelf by the Niffler. The Niffler shakes its head, sniffs the air, and scurries along the shelf. Stephen strolls along an aisle in the library, past cabinets filled with books. The Niffler scampers up the banister of a staircase in the library. It stops and looks down, sniffing. It then shakes its furry body before continuing up the banister. A heading in the book reads, "Creatures of the Deep." Various pop-ups rise from the pages, some featuring tentacles and fish-like tails.
What kinds of creatures lie hidden in the deepest, darkest depths of the ocean? Even today, scientists are making the most extraordinary discoveries about life forms that exist thousands of meters below the surface. But so much about the deep is a mystery to us. And it was an even deeper mystery to the adventurers who first began to sail around the world in the 1500s. These early explorations led to an explosion of extraordinary fables about our oceans. As sailors returned home with terrifying tales of huge sea monsters. It was also a time in our history when real-life science and ancient folklore began to overlap more than ever before.
In one room, glass containers are sitting on shelves. They're filled with a liquid and contain different specimens, including a snake and a fish with big round eyes.
Of all the eerie legends of the ocean depths, there is one that has enthralled us more than any other. The Kraken. Over 500 years ago, sailors first told of an enormous sea monster said to live in the waters off Norway and Iceland, which had long, snake-like arms covered in suckers for grabbing prey. Some stories reported the monster as being 2 kilometers in length, with tentacles as thick and long as ships' masts.
By the 18th century, scientists truly believed that the kraken was a living, breathing animal. And so it was included in all the highly respected scientific journals of the time, including the Systema Naturae, developed by the famous Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus. Was there really a huge monster living in the ocean depths that overturned ships and devoured sailors?
Specimens in containers.
This is the Natural History Museum's Tank Room, home to thousands of the most incredible scientific specimens. And there's one in particular that may explain our kraken myth, along with a little help from museum curator John Ablett.
Hello there, John.
Hello.
Oh, good to meet you. Thanks for showing me around your incredible... What the heck is that?
Well, this is Archie, our beautiful giant squid specimen.
This is a giant squid. One hears about giant squids and one imagines that they are maybe what people mean by sea monsters. Is this what they are? Are these the monsters?
Well, I mean, we don't really know what people were seeing when we think of these kind of old-fashioned sea monsters, but these are definitely a great candidate. I mean, they get up to about 13 metres, so Archie here is about 8.6 metres, so not fully grown.
This is a junior?
This is a junior. So the females, we think, get to about 13, the males about 10, 11.
Oh, I can't imagine what it must be like seeing one of those actually in the water.
One of the most elusive creatures on the planet, giant squid, are believed to weigh up to 500 kilos and inhabit the deepest oceans around the world. This incredibly rare footage was captured by scientists in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico in 2019. Thought to be a juvenile and measuring over 3.5 meters, the squid is attempting to feed on a decoy bioluminescent jellyfish. This is only the second time in history that a giant squid has been filmed in the wild.
So that sort of child's adventure book with a huge tentacle coming into the deck and wrapping itself around an unfortunate sailor is not very likely?
Pretty unlikely. I mean, these live at really great depths. We're thinking possibly down to 2,000 metres. And it's actually very likely they can't actually breathe at the surface.
Really? Oh, look, there's more. You've got suckers and... There, that's a wonderful.
Well, this isn't actually part of a giant squid. There is something that possibly gets even bigger. This is actually from a colossal squid. We think they get bigger than the giant squid, possibly up to 18 metres.
18 metres? Wow.
So should we have a look inside? Let's take a closer look.
John pulls out part of a tentacle.
Wow, I can see the suckers so clearly.
So here you can see just the very tip of a tentacle of a colossal squid. And you can see they have these traditional circular suckers with the sawtoothed edge, just like you see in lots of squid.
Yeah.
But also these very sharp talon-like...
Yes, I can see that. Ooh, goodness, they are, aren't they? Two or three in each sucker of these claws, these thorns. Even the ones that don't have thorns have a certain sort of raspy burr to them, don't they?
Yeah, they sort of have a serrated sawtoothed edge as well, so yeah. I mean, absolutely terrifying. You want to be caught by one of these.
Even bigger than its giant cousin, the colossal squid is the largest invertebrate on Earth, potentially almost as long as an early sailing ship. These mysterious creatures live in the icy depths of Antarctic waters, and most of what we know is based on a small number of carcasses found by deep-sea fishing vessels. Images like these are almost the only evidence we have of their existence. Did these enormous squid, found washed ashore or caught in nets long ago, launch the legend of the Kraken?
I mean, they really are so otherworldly, aren't they?
Yeah, and it's hard not to be scared at the thought of one of those tendrils coming out and grabbing you. It is a pretty primal nightmare.
It certainly is.
A heading says mermaids.
Sailors could spin wonderful yarns about the strange sights they saw at sea. But not all the tales they told were of the terrifying type. Some took a more appealing form. Mermaids have featured in legends from around the world for thousands of years. In 1493, the explorer Christopher Columbus, sailing to the Americas, saw what he believed to be three mermaids, describing them as not so beautiful as they are said to be, for their faces had some masculine traits. But some scientists now think that what he actually saw was a creature that is still found along the coasts of North America today.
Boats on a calm river.
Crystal River in Florida is home to these enigmatic animals.
There's one. This little nose popped up. Say hello.
A creature with a large paddle-shaped tail.
These incredible creatures are manatees or sea cows, and they're the ocean's largest herbivore or grazer, in their case, on seagrass. And despite their massive bulk, unlike me, they are incredibly graceful swimmers.
Local manatee expert Monica Scroggin has studied the population on this river for a number of years.
What brings the manatees to this place? Do they find it as beautiful as everyone else does?
So actually, it's the water temperature, but that's because they have a very small metabolism, so they have to eat about 10% of their body fat every single day. So for a 1,000-pound manatee, that's about 100 pounds of food.
My goodness.
Yes, it is a lot of green vegetables.
Manatees can be found along the coasts and rivers of North America, the Amazon in South America, and Western Africa. Though populations are on the rise in Florida, manatee numbers are declining worldwide, and they are considered vulnerable to extinction. Measuring over 3 meters in length, these gentle giants often travel long distances in search of seagrass. Manatee tails certainly look very mermaid-like. Perhaps it's the graceful way they move in the water that has inspired these legends. Or had the sailors who glimpsed them simply been at sea for too long?
And when you look at manatees, do you see merpeople, mermen and mermaids?
I do, I think. They have the similar shape. They have the similar tail, their flippers.
Yeah. Do they use them almost like hands? I mean, obviously they're not opposable thumbs or anything.
Right, but they almost are. You could think of their flipper like our hands, but only with skin covering it. Their bones look just like ours.
The manatee skeleton could also hold a clue to the mermaid myth. Take a look at their arms and hands, and you can see they are similar to ours. Yet their tail bones are unmistakably fish-like. It's easy to see how these skeletons washing up on shores long ago could have inspired the idea of a mysterious half-human, half-sea creature. Well, I'm not entirely sure about these theories, so perhaps I'd better take a closer look.
Here goes.
Now in a wetsuit, Stephen climbs down the ladder and into the water. Wearing goggles and a snorkel, he swims close to a big brownish-grey manatee, which lifts its head up. Stephen paddles slowly and watches the manatee as it grazes on the seagrass at the bottom of the clear river.
Wow, they are amazing. They're so much bigger underwater, and yet still so graceful. But they don't seem to mind my presence there. They just gently nibble away at that seagrass. Incredible.
An aerial view of Stephen paddling through the water next to the manatee.
It's not hard to imagine, is it, how a sailor far from home after a long voyage and maybe after a little tot of rum looks out and sees a manatee, and in his mind's eye, there's a mermaid, a beautiful mermaid. All right, perhaps a large tot of rum.
Meanwhile, the mermaid myth lives on.
The heading, Flying Beasts, on a page opposite a red feather.
Mythical beasts don't just lurk on land or slither through seas. From griffins to thunderbirds, harpies, to hippogriffs. Many magical creatures can be found on the wing, soaring across the skies.
A large black and white bird of prey flies through the air. It has a yellow beak and talons and fluffy-looking white feathers on its legs. Stephen approaches Chris O'Donnell, a falconer at Warwick Castle.
Oh, good Lord, Chris, hello.
Hi.
What's the name of this extraordinary creature?
This is Nikita, and she's a Stella's sea eagle.
A sea eagle? So beautiful. And that beak, is it a specialist beak for fish?
That's a serious beak. It's designed for cutting flesh, but a fish pulled out of the water at minus 40 is going to be a block of ice within a couple of moments. So that's what that tin opener is for.
And those trousers, I'd love those. Shaggy, shaggy feet.
On the soles of her feet, she's got almost like Velcro to enable her to grab hold of slippery fish and pull them off the surface of the water.
Of course.
Yeah.
As you can see, Nikita is no myth. She's all reality. Stellar sea eagles, they're amongst the largest eagles in the world, and they're formidable predators. There have been stories over the years, of course, of eagles attacking humans, which is why perhaps it isn't surprising that stories through the ages have been passed down of mythical winged beasts with enormous claws and beaks. In New Zealand, Maori mythology tells of a monstrous eagle known as the Pouakai that was said to eat humans. These stories may have been based on a real bird known as Hast's eagle, the largest eagle ever to have lived on the planet, with a wingspan of up to 3 meters. Hast's eagles were extinct by the 1400s, but generations of Maoris would have witnessed these enormous birds, perhaps leading to the Pouakai bird legend. And with that in mind, it's time for me to get a bit closer, so wish me luck.
Stephen puts on a glove that covers his forearm.
Right, Stephen, so essentially it needs to be upright.
Oh, like that.
Yeah, and now I'm going to place the bird on your arm on the top, and then you just got to keep your arm nice and level and just slightly away from your body. It's going to be heavy. So I'm now going to give you the weight.
Oh, my heavens. Wow. Enormous as you are, you'd be small compared to some of your ancestors, both real and mythical. One flying beast that appears in ancient tales from the Middle East is known as the Roc. Described as an enormous eagle, it was said to be strong enough to carry off an elephant. Inspiration for the Roc is believed to have come from the eggs of a real bird, Epiornis, which lived in Madagascar over 40,000 years ago. One of the largest flightless birds ever to have existed, at over 3 meters tall and weighing 500 kilos. Also known as the elephant bird, it went extinct around 1,000 years ago, but its eggs were so huge, as large as 150 chicken eggs, that people thought they must belong to the legendary Roc. Aren't you amazing? Well, I think it's time you had her back. So I'll hand her over to you. Perhaps it's the very mysteriousness of flight itself that has inspired these stories of legendary flying creatures over the centuries. That and a fear of the very powerful and very real birds themselves.
Nikita lands on Chris's glove.
Goodness. Fortunately, nobody's told Nikita how delicious I am, so I think I'm safe.
A heading in the book says, The Loch Ness Monster. There are images of a creature with a long neck sticking its head above water. One page shows the creature with humps protruding from the loch.
Stories of fantastical beasts aren't just a thing of the past.
Castle ruins and hills at the edge of Loch Ness.
And there's one world-famous legend that is alive and well here in Scotland. The Loch Ness Monster. The origin story of this
iconic monster can be traced back to around 1500 years ago when Irish missionary St. Columba was said to have encountered a beast in the River Ness.
Over the years, thousands of people have claimed to see Nessie, and there have been numerous attempts to find conclusive proof of its existence.
But none have been as promising or as high-tech as recent efforts.
Loch Ness Project Research Vessel.
I've travelled to the banks of this legendary loch.
Stephen,
hello.
Come aboard.
To meet Adrian Shine, a naturalist involved in this exciting new development.
Stephen gets on a boat with Adrian. The sky overhead is cloudy as they travel over the rippling water.
Why do you think that there's a special quality to Loch Ness? I mean, why has it retained such mystique over the decades?
Well, it's fascinating. It is probably, arguably, the most famous lake in the world. And it's quite large.
Yeah.
You could put the whole human population of the world into it at least three times over.
Seriously?
It is quite deep.
Gracious. Wow.
And it's hostile. So in that respect, it qualifies as a lost world. And we need lost worlds to make our mythical creatures at least credible, or more credible.
Yes, so it's big enough for there, if there were a monster, it could have credibly hidden for all this time.
The story of Nessie evolved over centuries, but it was in the 1930s that things really took off.
That was when the Loch Ness monster that we know and love today, it was born. There's the multi-humped sea serpent, and the plesiosaur, the idea of a prehistoric
with the long
monster,
neck.
Long neck, four flippers, stumpy body.
A creature with a long neck and four flippers moving through the water.
We used to spend a lot of time in trying to work out what was in Loch Ness with our fish nets, towing things like that around. Then we'd spend hours and hours and hours looking through microscopes, identifying things, counting things. But now, there is a much more elegant way.
A long tube.
Listen to this, delicious.
Oh. Just a minute. Lovely noise.
There we are.
Using a process called environmental DNA sampling, or eDNA, scientists examined the different types of animal DNA found in Loch Ness water.
And there we go.
That's it. My very own bucket of Loch Ness water.
That's right.
There are many different theories as to the Loch Ness monster's true identity. One that Adrian supports is that it could be an enormous eel. Eels are an elusive species. Much of their behavior and exactly how large they can grow is still a mystery to scientists. One of the biggest species in the world is the European conger eel, which is thought to grow to over 3 meters long. But some believe eels are capable of growing to a much larger size. Known as eunuch eels, their existence is somewhat controversial. Usually, adult eels swim into the Atlantic Ocean to breed, after which they die. But eunuch eels are said to be infertile, leading them to remain in fresh water and continuing to grow for many years, potentially to a huge length. So, will the DNA results confirm Adrian's suspicions?
Now, presumably, it will take a few days to get this analysed, but you've had previous samples.
Well, we certainly think we know what's in Loch Ness, and there weren't any great surprises from the DNA.
What have you found?
Bacteria, plankton, lots of fish, no reptiles.
No reptiles.
Sad, that was
slightly disappointing.
Didn't really expect them, to be quite honest, but there we are. But we got lots and lots of eel DNA. But of course, it would be the same DNA for an ordinary eel as for a huge eunuch eel. An ordinary eel which comes into Loch Ness, but likes it so much that it doesn't go back to the Sargasso Sea to spawn.
Oh, so it's avoids
it just
the famous
grows
life cycle.
Huge.
One of the things that's so intriguing is this latest DNA work that you've been doing still leaves avenues open to believing, doesn't it?
And that's the fun of it.
Yeah.
Nature surprises us all the time.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And so the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster continues.
A page of the book is turned and the heading reads Myths, Monsters and Movies. Perched on a building, an illustrated dragon suddenly breathes fire across a page. In the Natural History Museum.
Our passion for all things magical has never been stronger than it is today.
Many of the most popular books and movies of our time are based on myths, legends, and fantasy worlds, filled with some of the most extraordinary creatures you'll ever see. And now, with cutting-edge computer technology, we can bring them to life like never before.
Hogwarts in the daytime.
Now, behind these doors is something just a little bit special.
Carved pumpkins hanging down from the ceiling.
I've come to the making of Harry Potter at the Warner Brothers studio tour near London to see how the fantastic beasts of the wizarding world are brought to life and to discover how the natural world has often inspired these extraordinary creations.
This is quite an honour for me. They don't usually let muggles in here.
CGI creatures, a Zuwu with a flowing mane, a bow truckle with leaves on its head, and a leopard-like Nundu with a neck similar to a pufferfish.
But where do you start when trying to create a fantastic beast for the big screen? Surely a description in a book can only tell you so much. Well, I've come here to find out some of the tricks of the trade from visual effects supervisor Christian Manns. Oh, now, hang on. I think I recognise where we are. This is Dumbledore's office.
Yeah.
Now, Christian, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of CGI, as it's called. Do you spend your whole time just looking at a computer screen doing mathematical things to create images?
The brilliant thing about visual effects is there's a real marriage of the creative and the technical. And our inspiration, particularly with animation, is looking at creatures from all over the world and make the audience believe that what they're seeing is real.
Have you got some examples?
Well, in the second film, we had the Zuwu, a elephant-sized, really colourful big cat. In the script, it said that a Zuwu could travel 1,000 miles a day, and that led us to that idea of speed. So here, this is a design that bedded in for a while, actually, a cobra-like head.
Yes.
With a reptilian body. We got to the point of, you know, modelling it and animating it, but we were never quite sure about it. It didn't quite feel of our world. And then somebody came up with this design, this concept.
Goodness.
And we were like, yes, wow, that feels bonkers. And also felt very akin to some of the Chinese dragon dancers.
Yes.
The sort of ribbon, like,
I've taken a look at those too, and I know what you mean, and that exactly suggests it, that long, sinuous,
yes,
flowing tail.
And then kind of the cat-like face, and then the body, which in the end, lizards, was a lot of our inspiration. So from that, we'd look at wildlife.
So you've got coral, and is that a variegated tulip?
Yeah, and a fighting fish, yeah. And also we tried it with the sea anemone.
Yes, that's so surprising, because I can believe that you might look at lizards and you might look at large cats and things, but coral and flowers, and yet, once you point it out, you can see that. What's so interesting is that the most ancient stories of mythical creatures drew their inspiration from nature, and the most modern technological mythical creatures that you create also draw from nature. And I suppose as long as the lead times and the process of doing computer graphics is, it's nothing compared to the millions of years that nature has to try out new ideas.
Yeah, I think that's one of our biggest learning experiences, really, as Mother Nature's definitely better at it than we are. But she's had practice.
So much practice.
Inside the quiet Natural History Museum, there's a mastodon skeleton with two huge tusks. The Niffler's moving along one of them and sniffing. It stops for a moment and looks around. The Niffler continues along the tusk. There are more creatures on display in a large glass case.
But where on earth did all of this start? When did we very first create or imagine these mythical creatures?
When early humans began to draw, we depicted the world we saw around us, a landscape, people, and animals, like this magnificent mastodon. But we also began to create entirely imaginary creatures, too.
There are examples of these mysterious creatures painted in caves and on rocks found around the world, some dating back as far as 44,000 years ago.
No one really knows why these images were created, but perhaps the most reasonable explanation is that they were one of the earliest forms of storytelling.
I wanted to know more about this instinct to create mythical creatures, so I asked someone who knows a thing or two about telling stories. Author of the Harry Potter books and creator of Fantastic Beasts, J.K. Rowling.
A small pile of books.
Why is it that we humans have to tell everything through stories and examples? It's our great creative power, isn't it?
I think about this a lot, the fact that we're storytelling creatures, because to our knowledge, we are the only animal that does this.
Yeah.
And obviously it was an attempt, I think, certainly in terms of myth and folklore, it's an attempt to explain the natural world, things people didn't understand. I am very interested in story, inevitably. I'm not just interested in writing stories, yeah. I am interested in why we write stories.
Yes.
I'm even more fascinated by the fact that discrete cultures who'd never met create such similar archetypes and such similar creatures.
Yeah.
So we see the firebird, the phoenix, as I called it, but you see the creation of a firebird throughout different cultures.
Yes.
And what is that telling us about what it is to be human and what lives at the back of our minds in our subconscious? You often see this in magical beasts, that very similar beasts have been imagined by, after all, peoples who are living among different real animals. We're talking across cultures across different continents, and that fascinates me because that's clearly telling us about ourselves.
And a perfect example is the dragon.
There you are.
All over the world, in China, famously, of course. And what else are there? Mermaids.
Mermaids, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because where did that myth come from? Even in Africa, these inland countries,
yeah.
of course, have great rivers.
Yeah.
There is a form of mermaid, the Jengu. Oh. So, again, this is something that has been created across these different cultures. Why were British sailors imagining fish-tailed women? When people in Africa were imagining fish-tailed women, it's just extraordinary.
Do you think it's possible to invent a creature that has no basis in nature?
I think it would be exceptionally difficult.
Wouldn't it?
I created a creature in Fantastic Beasts, the original book, called a letifold.
Yes, a nasty piece of work.
Now, that is my worst nightmare. I really had there gone for something that would scare the bejesus out of me. Although I was taking the idea from a cloak, when I stood back from what I'd invented, I thought, that's just a manta ray.
And a manta means a cloak, doesn't it?
There you go,
yes.
Exactly. So basically, I've invented a manta ray that doesn't need water.
And the Niffler.
Well, I was going to say, the Niffler, exactly. So the Niffler is a bit of a favourite of mine. It's a treasure seeker, it likes everything that glitters, so it can locate treasure for you. So for those who don't know, a Niffler is a curious creature. I suppose it's a cross between a magpie in nature and a duck-billed platypus in
and
appearance.
A mole. Yes.
And a mole, exactly. But they used a platypus to get the snout-like appearance in the movie, which I adored. I mean, they ran these things past me and I just loved it. It gave it such an endearing appearance, I think. So it's exceptionally difficult to invent something. And often nature got there far better. Because you look at some of nature's extraordinary creations and you think, well, CGI will never match this.
Owls flying outside Hogwarts on a grey day.
You've created your own world that has its famous and knowable characters and creatures.
which must give you enormous satisfaction, and you've done it by examining the real world and the world of the imagination that our ancestors had all the way back through earliest myths.
I was thinking about the creatures because we were going to sit down and talk about this, and I realized that half the books fold without those creatures. You know, they're so important. Hedwig, the owl,
yeah.
And then we move through the Thestrals and the dragons, and they're key plot points, and obviously thematically they work in terms of life and death and power, and struggle and treasure, but I realized when I really focused on those creatures just how important they were, and that shows we have a deep need, I think, to be connected to the animal world.
The pages of an open book are turned rapidly. Fantastic Beasts, the future. The blue whale skeleton is bathed in a soft blue light. Now by himself, Stephen makes his way down the stairs towards the quiet hall.
Fantastic Beasts have been with us since the dawn of time. From the first imaginary creatures sketched on cave walls to the state-of-the-art animals that we see on our big screens today, they are a fundamental part of our own history. But behind these myths and legends from fantasy worlds lie the very real and truly magnificent animals of our own planet. Land, sea, and sky. The incredible creatures of this world have the skills and strengths to outdo even the most magical beasts. And whether in the real world or the realms of fantasy, there is so much that remains a mystery to us. If we keep our eyes and our minds open, who knows what might be out there?
He walks towards the exit, the Niflis sitting up high on a balustrade next to a pillar. It pulls the gold nugget from its pouch and holds it in its pink paws, while Stephen's strolling below. Stephen turns, frowning. Looking confused, he shakes his head and leaves, while the Niffler tucks the gold into its pouch.
Mm-hmm.